good question, a very fundamental question, right? Does a peak in the wealth t-test mean that the device is broken? And there's, it's not 100%. So what you have actually shown is that there is a relation between the plain text that you send in and the processing of that plain text. There's the relation between the power consumption and the plain text. There's a few things that can happen where you still see a wealth T spike, which actually can break apart. So one of the things that we've seen is there's a common optimization where you actually, so maybe one step back, when you're doing a differential power attack, you're usually attacking round one of the algorithm or you're attacking round 10 of the algorithm when you're talking about AES. That has to do simply because of the fact that you know the plain text, you don't know the key, and you want to catch, you know, the first time that it's using that key. So that's where you're doing your statistics on. So one of the optimizations is to, sort of security versus speed, is to put countermeasures on round one. It may slow down the algorithm, but decrease the leakage very significantly. Then round 2 to 9, you run with a leaky algorithm. And then 10, you implement the countermeasures again. So round 1 and round 10 cannot be attacked, and therefore cannot go to 2 or 9. But Welch T is going to show a huge nice spike in round 5.
So I understand that this gives you a bit of origin. Let me turn it into sort of qualitative into a quantitative question. And what's the gain? That you have as an attacker, if you can decide whether it actually falls into the rule of low power round 5 patterns.
Yeah.
That's kind of the game.
Okay, yeah. So what really is the advantage of this is you need a lot less traces to detect leakage than to do the key extraction. And I can use it to optimize my signal processing. So let's say I take 1,000 traces, and I can start seeing the T value go up. Now I have a lot of choices in what I can do. I can do frequency filtering, resampling, alignment, and all these things will either make it worse or make the leakage better. So on this batch of 1,000 traces, I can start tweaking my attack until I see this T value go up. And then when I do the actual attack, which is an attacker what I'm interested in, I now have the chain of steps that I need to apply on this batch of a million traces, which would otherwise take me a long time to process and tweak. So it's two things. So seeing a wealth T spike is not a guarantee that you can attack the key, but it allows you to detect leakage early on, tweak your attack that you can then use in the key extraction. Does that better answer your question?
Yes.
Perfect. Any other questions? Okay. I can actually also show that, that effect. So let's go to our earlier acquisition. So this is the one that I took this morning when we started off. And this was a faulty one. You may remember this picture where you see this T value going up. This is the first thing I showed this morning. And this is where I say, oh, you know, I have leakage. Now, I see leakage. What I can actually also do is try to do a, and now I'm running a few steps ahead of the program, but I can try to do a key extraction on this. So I have, in this case, 4,000 traces. I need to do it on the low-pass signal. This part. Let's see if I can get the key out. So this is when I do the actual key extraction attack. And I haven't tried it, so I don't. It may work, it may not work. Probably it's leave that running for a little while. So basically, what I did this morning was a few of these signal processing steps, right? So I took the absolute value, and then I took the low-pass version, and I applied the t-test on this thing. So let's try to see what happens if I do the... Maybe one thing to remember is we ended up with a t-value of about 15 in that specific trace set. So what if I hadn't done the absolute and the low pass? What if I just skipped the signal processing? So let's try to do the t-test on this specific part. I'll run it on this. Live updating while it's calculating the whole thing. Not really starting to go up. So you see that I'm actually not getting, it's kind of at the threshold, but what I like to see is something that's moving up rather than something that stays at the threshold. So by luck or coincidence, the two signal processing steps that I took this morning actually made sense because they boosted this t-value leakage. That other trace also. So here now it's done, and yeah, you see basically no cigar. So if you compare that to this one is after the processing, you actually see that the leakage is starting to occur. So this is for me a signal, okay, absolutes and then a low-pass filter was a good step to take. We can also try to, for instance, in the low-pass filter itself, there's different options I can take. So I ran it with, depending on how much you want to low-pass it. I can also run it with something else. Let's see what happens if I change 20 to 50 here. I'm going to get a stronger low-pass effect. Let's see how that affects the t-value. I need to calculate that. And then, yeah, I expect this to change. This is really an improvement over the old way of working where we didn't have a t-test yet. Just now, I'm doing it live here now, right? Instead of starting a module, going to get a coffee, maybe coming back 15 minutes later to check what happened. Actually, this was an improvement, it seems like. So the t-value went from 15 to about 20-ish, 25. So just turning a few knobs in my chain and really changed the amount of leakage here. Let's look if I actually was able to extract the key here. So I did the first order analysis. Come on. Should have sacrificed more to the demo about this morning. Oh, there it is. I'll go into detail later today, but what this is basically doing for each key in the AES, so there's 16 different measurements here, and it's trying to find which one has the best leakage, and it's trying to rank the keys. The best key it could guess is whatever it says here, but it also verifies whether this key is correct, and it says no. So even though on this trace set, I can already start the leakage seeing to grow. I don't have enough traces yet to actually do the key extraction. And yeah, we used to use this as a feedback mechanism. Like, can we get the key? Yes, or no, and in how many traces? What else can I show on a t-value? Are there any questions actually on this so far? Makes sense? Okay. Let's get into signal processing then. What do you guys, is anybody ready for a few minutes break or should I continue? Continue? Okay. Let's do that. So to conclude up on TVLA, so it's an effective to show early signs of leakage. Maybe to give you an idea, and this is really not rocket science at all, but if the T-value is below 50 to 100, we usually don't try yet to do key extraction, because typically you don't have enough traces yet. So you need to see that thing grow really until the higher numbers. So it's an indication of exploitability. It's, once you have it implemented, it's fairly push button, especially in the original FIPS phrasing where it was a test where the manufacturer would provide a trigger. So the testing lab basically has to hook up the oscilloscope, take the acquisition, press the button for the t-test, and then pass or fail would come out. So the signal processing steps were actually not mandated by FIPS or anything like that. So that's where the skill of the attacker comes back in, really. So if you have a device which, if you don't do any signal processing and it already leaks, that's pretty bad, right? So that you with these kind of basic tests, you can really easily say, okay, you have a really basic implementation, you didn't try anything in terms of countermeasures, so you're leaking, go back to the drawing board. Once you start implementing countermeasures, and in your testing, you don't do signal processing, that T-spike is going to disappear pretty quickly through misalignment, noise, etc. Which is fine if you put the bar of the security there. If you need to resist attackers that can do all kinds of signal processing tricks, yeah, you need to do in your analysis also these kind of tricks to see if you resist those as well. So that's really where it becomes a cat and mouse game between countermeasures and attacks, and more countermeasures and more attacks. The 4.5 value is kind of the theoretical cutoff. What we like to see is that log shape. It's actually, it looked like a linear line going up, but if you continue long enough, it's kind of more like a log shape. Once you start seeing that, you really know that you have some leakage. Okay. So, taking one step back to signal processing, can we improve it? So one of the important things that you can see when you start doing these things in practice is that you get misalignment. So that's illustrated by the top line there. It looks like you've been drinking too much and then staring at traces. So it looks like it's a little bit doubled up. But it's basically there's at some point in your acquisition process, either because of your acquisition setup or because of the target, there is a non-constant time between your triggers and when you start your scope and when the actual crypto is happening. So if that time is not constant, then you get alignment, misalignment. So there's one of your countermeasures right there. So if you generate something that's not constant, I'm forced to do alignment. Alignment is easy on a trace like the one above. If there's a huge band of noise on top of it, how do I know where those signals are if they're buried? So stacking countermeasures really makes make this kind of stuff hard as well. But anyway, as an attacker, our goal is the bottom graph there, where everything is nicely lined up. And the reason for that is basically those statistics that we're running, they assume that everything is nicely lined up. So if you break that assumption, the statistics don't work anymore, or they don't work as good anymore. Question I sometimes get is, can we do without alignment because it's hard? Sure. So just as with the t value, if you actually look at not so much the highest peak of the t value, but the way it looks like for the different samples, you'll see when everything's perfectly aligned, you see a very sharp t spike and then it goes back down. When things start getting misaligned, instead of a spike, you're going to see like this kind of Gaussian curve almost that's widening out. The more misaligned you have, the wider it gets and the lower that peak also gets. Until at some point it'll drop below the noise threshold and you can't observe it anymore. So the more misalignment you have, the harder it is to detect it. And you can either counter this by the smart way, by doing realignment in your software, or the dumb way, which is taking more traces. If you just, and it is a dumb way, but it often actually is also a way out. You just take more traces, and you wait for the statistics to catch up and increase that spike again. Just to give you an idea of a little bit of the mechanics involved in alignment. So if these are our traces. What you actually need to do is you need to find what we call a reference pattern. So you actually find some key point in that trace that looks distinctive enough that the algorithm can find it in all the other traces. And then based on finding that reference pattern, you just shift everything until it's back in line. So it's important that that reference pattern is distinctive, so you don't find it in other places. In other words, if you select round one of the AES algorithm as your pattern, you're going to have 10 other ones. And your matching algorithm doesn't know which one to go for, so it just picks the best one, which is not always round one. So in order to restrict that, we pick a distinctive pattern, so the black one, which will match the red trace there, or the red pattern there. We usually restrict how far the algorithm can look left or right. So we make sure that it doesn't go and seek through the entire trace trying to find something that looks like it, because you just increase the number of false positives that way. And so so you don't want the black peak there to match up with that nice red one in the other trace way down the line. And what we also do is we set a correlation threshold. So we say if you can find a pattern that looks similar enough to the pattern that I selected, just throw the entire trace out. Just forget about it. And this is kind of a manual tuning as well, again, and this is one of the parameters that you need to figure out. Alignment on these kind of traces is not hard. It just gets hard when there's more noise involved. So then you actually need to do you get into one of those nice problems that you need to untie a knot, because in order to do alignment, you need a pattern. In order to have a pattern, you need to take the noise out. So what you usually do to denoise something is just take an average of a whole bunch of traces, and the noise will cancel out. But in order to get a good average, you need the traces to be aligned. So there's an issue there. And usually you can work your way through just by beginning just averaging and hoping for the best, then taking a pattern, doing another alignment, using that average pattern, then you're getting closer to your target and you loop that a couple times until things start clearing up. So there are a whole bunch of tricks here that you can do. And then finally you have this beautifully aligned trace. So here is just what we would see on our screen. So you see that they're not overlap. You feel a little bit drunk. What we do is we take one of these traces manually, we shift it until we start seeing like, hey, okay, this looks good. But that's just for one trace, you can't do that for a million. But then you get a feel for how far you actually are allowed to shift left and right. And you can also do something called a correlation analysis. In this case, consider it the t-test, but then for plain text and ciphertext. So you can actually detect whether your plain text is being processed and your ciphertext is being processed. There's no secrets there, so you can't use it for key extraction, but you can use it to verify alignment. Because if your alignment is off, then these t-test or correlation calculations will also not show the leakage of this plain text or ciphertext. In other words, it's another indication that says, okay, you're good or you're not good. So if that's what it looks like on an aligned trace set, on the left there, so this is a typical pattern actually for a crypto algorithm. On the left you'll see the plain text leak, then you see a bunch of nothing, and then you see the ciphertext leak. But if you do this on an unaligned trace set, it might look something like this. So it's very clear, like, okay, I got work to do before I continue analyzing this trace. There's other things that we can do. So in the top here, you're seeing an EM signal, which is, as I mentioned, it's bipolar. It's the derivative of the power. So sometimes you need to do a bunch of processing to actually start visualizing patterns. So the top, yeah, I see kind of a repeated pattern, but it's hard to interpret what's going on there. But if I, for instance, calculate the envelope of that signal, which is what I was doing this morning as well, as the absolute value and then a low pass, so basically the amount of energy in the peaks, and I plot that out, you can actually see that there's something that really differs at around 35 there, and then around 82 there's this large dip. So even with a little bit of signal processing, you can already start clearing up, at least at the process level of a target, what's going on. And this may help you further find your target. You probably won't see much difference between the top and the bottom trace. And neither do I if I stare at it, but that's actually a good thing. Because what we've done here is we've compressed the traces. So remember when I was taking a lot of samples in my acquisition, and that would slow down everything. You want to reduce your scope window, but you can do more things. So you can actually also, for instance, compress two samples into one. Saves you half the disk space, and you're averaging. So you're losing some data, but it might still be enough to extract the leakage. So in this specific example, the top one is 100,000 samples, the bottom one is 40,000 samples. So that's a 2.5 times speed up that you gained, and at least visually it doesn't look like a lot of information was lost. And again, you can use t-testing or things like that to verify whether you're actually losing information or not. Interesting side effect of compression is that sometimes it will increase the leakage if you do it smart enough. We'll get to that in a second. So also for signal processing, it's not a waterfall. I can also do interesting tricks in the frequency domain. So what we've been looking at until now is time domain traces, which basically means at what point in time, you know, what was the amplitude of my signal. If you guys may remember from your digital signal processing courses, I do. If you do a Fourier transform, you can also look at things in the frequency domain. In other words, if I have a very low sine wave and I transform it into the frequency domain, I'm going to get a spike very low down. If I have a very fast sine wave, I can get a spike high up in the frequency. And the real interesting thing is that you can map signals from one to the other and back. So there's no information loss between time and frequency domain. So just consider it as looking at your signal from a different angle. If we're talking about side channel analysis, and we seem to be doing that this morning, there can be some interesting things that happen. For instance, your leakage can be concentrated around a certain frequency. So if your crypto core is running at 78 megahertz, you might actually, or maybe I should take this example, if your crypto core is running at 4 megahertz, you might actually see a large spike there. And it could be that that's where all your leakage is concentrated. And this means in the time domain signal it's spread out over a longer period of time, but in the frequency domain it's actually mapped onto one frequency, which can help you do your, first of all, your leakage detection, but it can also help you in filtering, because if you know that all your, or at least a large part of your signal is around that 4 megahertz frequency, I can just filter out all the other frequencies, because they're noise. So that really helps, again, to increase this signal to noise ratio. I don't want to get into too much background here about Fourier series, but one thing to keep in mind is that when we're dealing with digital circuits, you're typically talking about block waves and spikes. You're not actually talking about sine waves, whereas all the math is based on sine waves when you're talking about Fourier transfers. But you can represent these block waves actually as a sum of sine waves. And the more sine waves you add, the closer you get in your approximation to a block wave. So if I take one sine wave, the closest you can get is the sine wave of the same frequency. But you can actually add something we call the second harmonic and the third harmonic, and it's actually different sine waves with different frequencies that you keep on adding that will keep getting closer to this block wave. And you can keep on doing that. So if I have 100 harmonics in there, I get almost a block wave, and it gets closer and closer to the final block wave. Now, why am I telling you this? That's because it's actually not too well visible in this picture. But what you very typically see is that you don't see one spike at 4 megahertz, but you see one at 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, etc. And that's all because there's actually a block wave of 4 megahertz plus all those harmonics. The block wave at 4 megahertz is represented in this picture as a sine wave of 4 plus 8 plus 12 plus 16, etc. So when you're doing your frequency filtering, you don't want to just keep 4, you want to keep all the harmonics as well. A little bit of background. So I was talking before about resampling or compression. One of the simplest ways to do it is to just look at, we typically look at the clock frequency, and we take one entire clock cycle, we take all the sample points in there, and we compress it. In other words, take the average of all those values that we've measured, and we represent it by one sample. So this can significantly increase or decrease the number of samples that you need. But this is kind of the dumb way, and it usually works, but you can be a little bit smarter. And that actually has to do with, let's skip this, with the fact, remember this morning when I showed that picture of one clock cycle, where you see that spike and then it kind of dies down? Usually the information is in that spike, because that's when most of the transistor activity is actually happening. And the rest, kind of noise, it's just waiting for the next clock cycle to hit. So instead of taking the entire clock cycle, you can also do a little bit of peak detection and then only take a few samples around that peak and then compress those into one. And that's what I mentioned earlier, that if you do your compression in a smart way, you may actually increase your signal while decreasing the amount of data that you have to process. So that's really a nice double win there. We do more tricks during resampling as well. So when you have this EM signal, while we're resampling, we might as well turn it into a power signal. So we'll take the absolute value of it before compressing it. I would almost say almost exclusively, clocks are not as stable as you think they are. So I may say a clock is 4 megahertz, but it might drift between 3.95 and 4.05 megahertz, which is fine for the device, it'll run. But if I'm doing this kind of synchronization, that means that sometimes my clock cycle will be more samples and sometimes it will be less samples. So I need to detect where these edges are, basically to make sure that I don't lose synchronization with the actual target. So I switched them around here. That was the signal processing part. Let me see what time we're at. 9:15. So I have about one more hour. I actually want to explain a little bit about the background of correlation power analysis as well, so you get an idea of what this last step is. We've acquired traces, we've processed them, we've done leakage detection, we've gone back and optimized our signal processing until we're happy with the entire chain. And now we're ready to take a huge batch acquisition. It's maybe 100, 1,000 times larger than we used before in order to extract the key. So I want to go through that process with you guys.